Good day, and welcome to episode 7 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. This week, we're joined by members of GRUHA, the Guelph Renters Union and Housing Advocates, a new tenant organization in Guelph that came into being in March of 2020. They'll be sharing their thoughts on the housing crisis, both pre- and mid-pandemic, analyzing Bill 184 and other housing legislation, and outlining their efforts to build tenant solidarity and prevent evictions in Guelph. Speaking to us at our July 30th, 2020 Breezy Online Breakfast were Dustin Brown, who you recognize as a regular part of the Breezy team, and his GRUHA associates Lily Bent and Kinnery Chaparral. You'll hear our moderator for that session, Hina Mistry, who welcomed in Councillor Phil Ault and participant Ted Pritchard into the conversation. Here's Dustin Brown to start us off.
GRUHA is Guelph Renters Union and Housing Advocates, and that's an organization that is brand new, just started in March in response to things that we were seeing unfolding from the pandemic and the lockdown associated with it. It's an organization that exists to build solidarity between tenants in Guelph. Anybody who's renting from a landlord essentially is welcome to join and take part in the activities of this organization. And what we're trying to do, we have a lot of different short-term and long-term goals. The short-term goals, of course, are the reason that we started to exist was we were seeing the writing on the wall, seeing that with the lockdown and lack of income support, people were not going to be able to afford their housing costs, specifically rent, because as tenants, that's what we're looking at. And we were seeing a danger of, not immediately because there was an eviction moratorium, but eventually there would be a massive crisis in which people who had not been able to afford rent for weeks or months were going to be in danger of eviction. And we're seeing that play out now, where we are currently at the end of the official state of emergency issued by the province. And now we're seeing that eviction notices are coming in. The Landlord and Tenant Board is going to be opening up as early as next Monday for hearings. And what we see is our job for tenants in Guelph is to do what we can to prevent the impending evictions that are going to come up due to failure to pay or other nefarious or unjust evictions. In preparation for this moment, we've spent the past few months doing outreach on the street, but mostly online. It's a very weird time to start an organization and try to build a name for it, because everything that we're doing, due to precautions around COVID, we had to do a lot of online outreach, which is not as effective as in-person outreach. But we've started to get down on the ground again. We started to get down on the ground over the past few weeks, rather. And really just trying to build that base, to build that network of tenants across Guelph, across buildings, across different landlord groups, in order to have enough numbers that there is more of a kind of a power broker situation that tenants have as an option. So there are a lot of organizations that will help already with legal support for tenants and just kind of understanding what tenant rights are, which is a major issue. And we definitely need more services like that. And that's what people have been, by and large, coming to us for at this point. But we also need an organization in town that has kind of a long-term viability, a long-term way to influence policy decisions that are made, to influence the way that tenants are able to live and breathe in this city. So we're trying to get as many people highly connected as possible. So we started off with just a small group of us. It started off really as a Facebook event called Keep Your Rent April 1st. This was in correspondence with the Toronto Keep Your Rent campaign, which has been initiated by Parkdale Organize. And from that Facebook event, it attracted a lot of activists in town, mostly young ones who, you know, are students or recent students or otherwise. Those people started getting together. Eventually we grew to a volunteer base of 40, which is where we're sitting around right now. There's of course a core group of people who are making a lot of the, you know, kind of steering committee type decisions and trying to like develop and describe the character of the organization. But that's where we're sitting. We have, I'd say, you know, 15 to 20 active volunteers and 40 who are there for sporadic events and purposes and outreach activities. So I talked earlier that we have, you know, short-term and long-term goals. I would say short-term, we don't want any evictions arising from COVID. It's incredibly unjust that people were told to stay home to keep themselves and their communities and their families safe. We're unable to make the same amount of income while doing so due to lost or cut hours. And, you know, those people are still expected to pay all the same expenses, which is just incredibly unfair. So we want to see a policy situation arise in which people cannot be evicted due to lost income that was no fault of their own. I think that's a bare minimum that tenants are expecting. Unfortunately, it's not the case that seems to be arising, but that is we're gonna do whatever we can as a union to disrupt, to change public opinion, or to otherwise defend tenants who are in immediate danger of eviction in Guelph. But long term, we want to keep building a network such that we're training people on the ground who are living in apartment buildings or under particular landlords. We want people to feel empowered to form tenants associations where they can collaborate and negotiate in solidarity with their neighbors and start to really swing the balance of you know, what happens in the building and who controls everything, and, you know, when are rent increases allowable and when are evictions going to happen. We want tenants to be able to organize around all of those things and to act in their own best interests. That takes a level of organization that is going to take months or years to build up. We recognize that. But as a start, we're just trying to find some local champions who are willing to try to start that process in their own buildings. And we're developing training programs as well as having a lot of one-on-one conversations with those people in order to build their skills and their confidence in order to do so. I think that's kind of all I want to say for an intro. Lily, do you have anything to add?
No, I think that was pretty thorough.
Cool. Yeah, I will say I think there are some questions coming up regarding, you know, Bill 184 and you know, kind of some differences between the Guelph and the Toronto context, but we'll let those questions come up and answer them when they're here.
Thanks, guys. This is really informative. So I did have those questions lined up for you guys. So you're ready. But before we get into those, I did want to ask a little bit more about just like renters in general and like why, you know, just so the listeners can learn a little bit more about, you know, well, what's the difference between renting and homeowning, right? And how does that actually impact poverty? So how close to the poverty line do renters live relative to homeowners? And does renting create a greater economic divide? But also, even just to break that question down again, like what percentage of income generally goes to housing when people are renting versus paying a mortgage? I don't know if you guys can you guys speak to that?
I know that it's for a lot of people who rent, 50% of their income or more often goes to rent. I know mine is 70%, but I live off very low income. And because rent goes up pretty much every time a tenant leaves. So I find that like moving around, it gets less and less possible to save. So you get stuck in the cycle of renting and it getting more and more. Like when I moved out of my parents' house 9 years ago, my rent was like 10% of what I was making. Like it wasn't really that bad, but now it's impossible to find something that's under 50% for people who live at the poverty line.
I don't know about any particular percentages, but there's certainly an economic divide that arises naturally from what exists in this system, like the tenant and landlord relationship, and just the way that private property is used to propel the housing model. To look at it simply from far away, rather than a snapshot of percentages. What we have is a situation in which it's very clearly illustrated that people with money and with capital already can easily buy up more real estate in order to turn it into rental units, which gives them even more income, which allows them to buy further property. So, with respect to all the mom and pop landlords out there, there's a big problem of financialization of the housing market, and that's why we've seen a lot of really, really upshoots of rent prices. So in Guelph, in October, I think the market rent for a one-bedroom apartment was on average $1,500 a month. And if we go up the 401 to Toronto, then we're looking at, I think as of February, the market rent for a one bedroom apartment again was $2,300 a month. So already, if we're looking at minimum wage earner working full time, then you're making about $2,100 a month. If you're on CERB, $2,000 a month. If you're on CESB as a student, then it's $1,250 a month. And that's getting into really dangerous territory. I mean, it's not out of the ordinary for a renter to pay more than 50% of their rent or more than 50% of their income on rent. But, especially in Toronto with current conditions, it's really hard to mathematically make ends meet. I don't see how there's a way that a minimum wage earner can sustainably afford a new rental unit in Toronto without co-living or other arrangements, which is very frustrating to see. I think, Hina, could you repeat the other parts of your questions? I think you had the percentage question, but...
Yeah, so, and I think you guys kind of answered it to some degree, but what percentage of income generally goes to housing when renting versus paying a mortgage? And then the other one was just how close to the poverty line do renters live relative to homeowners? And does renting create a greater economic divide?
Got it.
Yeah.
Just kind of functionally, again, looking from the top down, mortgages on average on the whole are going to be a lower cost than rent is. Otherwise, having a rental property wouldn't be profitable for a landlord. I mean, there are a lot of costs that are wrapped up in rent that go towards, the bills that a landlord has to pay, including a mortgage and property taxes and in some cases, utilities. So those are all things that renters are paying for with their income. It would be nice if there were a rent to own kind of situation happening, if that were the norm, but usually the case is that renters are having to essentially pay for the mortgage of their landlords and buy off the asset that the landlord went into debt in order to secure, which is unfortunate. It kind of necessarily puts an antagonistic relationship between tenants and landlords, which nobody wants to see, but that's just kind of the way it is by design. As to the question of how many tenants are living in poverty as opposed to homeowners or landlords, Again, I don't have the specific percentages of those, but I think we should think also of people who are recipients of ODSP or OW who often will have no choice but to rent.
Live below the poverty line on ODSP, right? Because if you get base ODSP, it's only $1,100. So.
Yeah, and Lily, how much of that is the housing accommodation? $435.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so good luck in this city trying to find a rental unit for $400-something.
And OW is only $750 total, so like it's even worse.
Yeah, and it's just interesting too, because there's been a lot of graphics sort of floating around recently too about how, you know, like, well, what is, you know, in order, if you're working, you know, full time on minimum wage, then like what is like the wage that you'd need to be earning, and how many hours a week that you'd need to be working in order to actually afford a, you know, like just a one bedroom apartment. Like those graphics have been floating around, but even before, like, I feel like sometimes, you know, the conversation is, okay, well now, you guys haven't been doing this obviously, but you know, the conversation is, oh, you know, like this crisis has made worse or exacerbated things that were already a problem back, you know, a year ago, right? So like I remember reading back in September that, you know, it was impossible, basically there is no affordable housing available in Guelph if you make minimum wage and work full-time. Like there isn't anything, right? So I was wondering if you guys could speak a little bit to how difficult it was to find affordable housing before the COVID lockdown started, and in what ways did the COVID lockdown make it worse?
It wasn't easy to find affordable housing in the first place. A lot of landlords in Guelph have illegal rules, to be honest. You'll go look at a place and they'll say no ODSP, no OW. So people who are the lowest bracket already struggle to find places. And if they're judging people based off that, you know, they're judging people based off other things to do with their income as well. So like looking around, it's a free for all for cheap apartments. Like there's like 200 people applying for anything that's actually affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before the crisis. Now, I can only imagine it getting worse with how many landlords I keep seeing being like, I don't want to have to deal with this anymore. Tenants are too hard. They're not paying. And like, it's causing more of a like animosity between the groups as well. So like the housing crisis was already an issue here, but with lost income, I'm assuming it'll probably get worse.
Yeah. I think I echo what you're saying there, Lily, that there's been a lot of developed mistrust between landlords and tenants, especially over the course of this pandemic, because there's really no way for landlords and tenants to meet each other's needs in a crisis like this. It's again a kind of an antagonistic relationship by design. It has to be that way. You know, if a landlord is depending on a tenant's income that doesn't exist, then they're not going to trust tenants anymore. Or, you know, you'll have a lot of, you know, empathetic ones out there that understand the situation and know that they can't do anything about it. But by and large, the bigger ones like Skyline and Williams and McDaniel, we're seeing them being, you know, very rough with their tenants, demanding that rent be paid by a certain date, illegally entering apartment units in order to try to collect rent arrears and things like that. I can only speak from personal experience in regards to my own rental housing journey in Guelph. I've lived in the same place since I got here in September of 2016. So coming up on 4 years now, and we've been on a month-to-month lease agreement that goes back even before my tenancy. So that's a good snapshot, actually, for how much the rent game has changed. I mean, we're as a group of four housemates, we're paying just under $450 a month each for a really small, dingy kind of apartment unit with not a lot of common space. That's close to downtown. That's a really good price. You know, we're not really getting a lot of space, but the location's good, and we're, you know, just paying a shot, just shy of $450. And since then, rent prices have gone up significantly. And if I look at Kijiji, if I ever have an inkling that I want to move and try to find a rental unit that's going to, you know, meet those same criteria, it's looking like 600 or 700 now. That's a really difficult increase to stomach, and not one that is affordable for me. So if I were to have to find new housing, I would really, really need to configure as a graduate student, how am I going to pay for that? What am I going to do with the $300 or $400 left over a month? It's really an impossible question to ask, but one that tenants all across this city, in situations like mine or worse, are forced to answer all the time. I would say, just to answer the question of how things have changed during the pandemic, it's a lot harder now for tenants to get showings of units before moving in. So there might be issues of repairs or condition of the unit that the tenant doesn't get to see until they move in, because whatever previous tenant was living there didn't want to allow anybody in for a showing, very reasonably. They don't want to increase the risk of transmission. And I think also, you know, it's probably a good segue to bring up probably the most significant news for tenants during the pandemic, which was the passing of Bill 184 by the provincial government, which significantly erodes tenants' rights to a point where now, I don't want to get into this too much because I know, Hina, you're going to have a question about it, but now tenants could be taken advantage of given this new legislation.
Yeah, there's a lot of room to exploit it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll leave it there for you, Hina.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of my next questions. So if you guys wanted to expand on that a little bit, and then I wanted to move into a discussion of just, I think that discussion would help me segue into just municipally and what, you know, what can be done to work with landlords in the city. But I'll let you guys just elaborate a little bit on Bill 184 for those who aren't necessarily aware of the ways in which it affects tenants.
Sure. Yeah, Lily, you've read it up and down, so.
So there's like a lot of dangerous language being used in it. Like it leaves a lot of wiggle room for exploiting tenants. They've made it so currently any disputes have to be heard by the LTB, like the Landlord Tenant Board. But Bill 184 allows for rent repayment plans to be drawn up outside of the board between landlord and tenant, which could potentially include a Section 78, which allows for eviction orders to go ahead without notice to the tenant if the tenant does not follow through with payments. So like this could lead to landlords, they're essentially going to get people to sign repayment plans without going through the Landlord Tenant Board, which gives them connections to people who will educate them on their rights, people who help them understand repayment, people who will help them understand what they can budget for, how to budget, what the law means, what's working in their favor, if they can even afford it. And by doing so without the Landlord Tenant Board, it leaves a lot of room for landlords to be able to manipulate tenants who normally don't know their rights. Like tenants, I found a stat that said it was like 90% of tenants don't know they can even like bring up problems. So there's probably a lot of people who have been brought repayment plans who thought they had to sign them, that they have like no choice. And landlords are open to be able to manipulate that pretty easily. The pandemic is probably the worst time to make changes like this. Like it leaves the poorest amongst us pretty open to exploitation. And from what we've seen, especially in bigger cities with bigger buildings, is that they're not like, they don't really care about leaving people homeless during this. Eviction notices are going through regardless. Bill 184, beyond removing people from their rights with the Landlord Tenants Board, it also brings up that landlords can go for compensation from former tenants for interfering with another tenant's reasonable enjoyment of the residence. So this could be used, if you're too loud, if you've got kids, if the, like you could be in a single place with the landlord's want for this place to be reasonably used wasn't up to their standards. So they can go after you for funding. And this could be extremely ableist. Like a lot of people, you know, who have like, you know, autism, mood disorders, ADHD, stuff like that, stim or get loud, and like you can't be expected to always be completely silent. And the fact that landlords can come after you for compensation now is brutal. And they also have made it so that if you don't catch improperly increased rent on your own, it's like it's void. If you've gone a year paying improperly increased rent and the landlord tenant board tells you then, or you find out later, it's completely fine. The landlord gets to keep that illegal raise. And the only thing that seems to work in the favor of tenants in this bill, which doesn't really, is it increases the cost of the consequences of terminating tenancy in bad faith. So it's like it went from like being like $25,000 to $30,000 to like $100,000 fines now for landlords who illegally evict tenants, which will deter smaller landlords doing that. But it's not going to deter million-dollar profiting businesses when they can evict and then raise the rent on the place and not be hurt at all. And also, all the changes apply retroactively to when the province declared the state of emergency. So people who might have signed things not knowing all the, like, not knowing that this was going to happen back in like April are now subject to changed rules for something they've already signed.
So I just want to make it really clear what the situation of Bill 184 or what Bill 184 make possible. I've been talking with a tenant who is a single mom, three kids, and is a registered massage therapist. So in normal times, a pretty steady profession, decent income, decent rights. Lots of people want massages. They're great. Wish I could have one right now. That single mom, now due to the pandemic had to shut down, her business and is receiving CERB. So it's getting, $2,000 plus a bit for supporting the kids. Her rent is $2,300 for the three bedroom apartment that her and her kids need. So already we're seeing a situation there where she's not going to be able to afford full rent, and purchase all the food and medication and other essentials that she's going to need for herself and her kids. Maybe she's even supporting family members outside of that. You never know with the world that we live in right now. So that person has been unable to pay rent out of any source other than their savings account. So, I mean, I know savings are for a rainy day, but this could have been a much better situation for life accounts as well. This tenant was, okay, good. So saying that tenant was offered a repayment plan back in April. And after talking with Gruha, decided not to sign it because that was the general suggestion that we were giving out to tenants back then and continue to give until this day. But if she had signed that repayment plan that said, you know, I'm going to pay this much rent for the following months in order to make up for all the lost rent that I missed, then she would have had to pay while she was not making income. She's returned to work now, but she would have had to pay during the previous months. She's also concerned, of course, about a potential second wave in the fall. Which would cause her to lose her income and shut down her business again. So if she had signed that repayment plan and then a second wave had come, and for one day she was a dollar short on the rent for, let's say, October 1st, then her landlord could file under this new agreement and tell the landlord and tenant board that, hey, me and this tenant, we privately negotiated a repayment plan. She's not living up to it. I would like to file for her to be evicted. And the landlord and tenant board under Bill 184 can now evict within 10 days that tenant under this new agreement. This used to be the case only with a repayment plan that was issued by the landlord and tenant board, but now it is the case with privately negotiated repayment agreements in which the tenant is not going to have ample access to legal services or know their rights. Statistics I've seen show that about 3% of tenants, as opposed to 90%+ of landlords, have access to a lawyer. So any repayment plan that's drafted up without the supervision of the LTB is likely going to be exploitative in some way. So this puts that tenant with three kids and a lot of others in danger if they really weren't aware of their rights up front. And yes, Lily's point, I think, is really worth hammering home, the fact that this bill was drafted. It had its first reading before the pandemic. But now that it's been passed, it's been made effective, retroactive to March 17th, which was the exact day that everybody went into lockdown. And really close to the day that Doug told tenants to work something out with their landlords. So what tenants were told was sign a repayment plan and everything will come out hunky-dory. But what he didn't tell tenants was that there was going to be a law passed that would erode their rights if they did sign that repayment agreement. Which is very unfortunate.
Thanks, guys. This really helps illuminate just the details of, you know, why exactly this is a problem. I didn't realize like the retroactive application of Bill 184. Anyway, so I think this is a good segue though into a discussion about what can be done to address all this. And I'm going to ask three questions and then open it up to you both, but also to Phil and James to maybe comment on things pertaining to the municipal level. So the three questions are, first, what can be done at the municipal level with rent issues? And then we had a question from Ted Pritchard. Ted asked, is there any consideration to working with City Hall and landlords? Rental income is their income. The big landlords will have enough cash to weather several months of no income. Someone with one or two units has lost the income they have depended on to survive over several months. And then James asked, what can we do to reduce that landlord-tenant animosity?
I think to a certain point that animosity is hard to deal with, because no matter what, the landlord is in a pretty exploitative relationship with tenant. If landlords want there to be no animosity during this, they need to work with their tenants in ways that don't back them into corners, that doesn't make them sign repayment plans that they couldn't possibly deal with, don't have them sign anything without them having proper legal help along with them. And, you know, treat them like a peer, not like, you know, your employee.
Yeah, but I agree with that. There's inherently by design always going to be a power imbalance, which is, like Kennery's saying in the chat there, it's inherently imbalanced. And there's really, I mean, but you can, if you're a landlord and you want to be nice and perceived as being a good person by your tenants, then, I mean, it's quite simple. I think Lily said it quite well. Don't back tenants into corners that they can't get out of and they won't bite back. So as for what the municipality can do, we're working in lockstep with people in Toronto, which is, you know, important. They have a lot of built experience. Parkdale Organize has been doing tenant battles for more than 4 years now, and they actually threw a successful rent strike for Metcalf tenants back in 2017, which I would really encourage people to look at. Really inspirational moments for tenants who were fighting against unjust rent increases in their buildings. But yeah, so they have all this expertise and experience with these struggles. And what they've been saying recently is that Mayor John Tory has the power to temporarily suspend evictions under the Emergency Management and Civil Protections Act. That's what people in Toronto are saying. And some lawyers have come out and supported that statement as well. other lawyers, and apparently including the City of Toronto lawyers, are saying that's not the case, that the mayor's office actually does not have that emergency power. Kennery, you had a reading of the EMCPA, and I was wondering if you would be able to bring to light what you learned along that process.
Sure. So the EMPUC, Emergency Management Civil Protection, EMCPA, offers municipalities the power, more power, seemingly, but that power is mostly limited to municipally governed things. So that power cannot override provincial or federal laws. There's no clause that allows that to be more important, but there is a clause that allows the lieutenant governor to override provincial laws for the safety of people. So that is one potential avenue in the Emergency Management and Civil Protections Act that could be gone down. But as, like, again, I read through it and I've seen kind of arguments on both sides. I am not seeing a way that that can be used. It does mostly limit municipalities to acting within, they have to have a plan beforehand usually, and they have to pass specific bylaws, and they still have to give precedence to provincial and federal law.
Right. Yeah, so there's still, we need some clarity on our end, what specifically Toronto is pointing to when they're saying that. We also, I mean, I should clarify that we're not lawyers, we don't practice law, but we did talk to one person in Guelph who practices law who also didn't see a provision in the EMCPA that would allow the municipality to suspend evictions. But one other potential avenue that ties in with recent discussions about what the role of police is in our community is to ask the Police Services Board to issue a motion that says, you know, we're not going to help to enforce evictions for a certain time period for emergency measures. And that could very well be in the best interest of the city and of the police services in general. Just acknowledging that if there is a bit of a wave of evictions in this city, then a lot of the services that we already have for the unhoused and underhoused are going to be further overwhelmed. We're going to see a lot of dissent, people really, you know, bringing their desperate situations into action. And that's not going to look good for anybody. So it could be argued very, very much in that it's in the best interest of the municipality, both from a budget perspective and from an unrest perspective, to do whatever they can to suspend evictions and to fight against Bill 184. I will say just a nugget of information that's been lost thus far in this discussion, which is officially the state of emergency in Ontario ended yesterday. And within, I think the lieutenant governor, the courts of Ontario ordered that evictions would start at the end of the calendar month of the day that the state of emergency was lifted. So that's been lined up to happen exactly at the time that Bill 184 and Bill 195 with the continuation of emergency powers for the province have been enacted. So now, you know, this situation with Queen's Park now suspended and not meeting to further any new laws or amendments, this is kind of a situation that we may be stuck with for a while. However, I received a link yesterday from somebody that showed that Toronto City Council has now voted to legally challenge Bill 184 or certain aspects of it, which we'll say is a start. I mean, Bill 184 isn't the whole problem for tenants. There is a lot of other stuff that existed pre-pandemic, as we've already discussed, that tenants really need addressed. But at the bare minimum, being an environment in which nobody's going to be evicted without a hearing would be welcome to see.
It feels more like landlords in the city should be working with tenants. That's kind of their bridge to gap, because the thing about renting is that, yes, this might be your income, but you made this choice to have a investment as your main income. Investments are known to rise and fall. You're not guaranteed a return on your investment every single time. And the fact that all the burden keeps being put on tenants to work with everybody else instead of people who should logically assume that if they're getting hurt, their tenants are too, and they should work together. So I think to branch that animosity, a lot of it's got to come from the people who have the uneven power dynamic and not the bottom up.
Yeah, exactly. It's really, you know, tenants are, you know, we're working to fix this a little bit, but tenants are disparate. Tenants don't really have kind of a central power source with which they can, you know, derive the leverage they need in order to negotiate fairly. If you're negotiating with the threat of eviction on your doorstep, then it's, I think, by definition, under duress, whatever negotiation you end up configuring there. And landlords know that, and they very much take advantage of the threat of eviction in order to get tenants to sign on to certain things. And I'll also say, I mean, what can tenants do really in order to satisfy a landlord's need for income? If somebody made that choice to derive income from a rental property, or even from their basement, or you know, they have a co-living situation, then, you know, that's not a scenario that a tenant can fix. It is something that the federal and provincial governments had the opportunity to fix back in March or April, because the feds could have used their powers under the Constitution Act or the Banking Act, and they could have suspended the collection of mortgages. They could have ordered banks to stop collecting mortgage payments for the duration of the pandemic, and then from there could have worked with the provinces or hassled them into making sure that rent payments were taken off the table as well. And that could have been a really good universal situation for anybody who has housing payments that they need to worry about, and could have prevented a lot of the economic problems that we're seeing today. What it would have impacted negatively, though, are the bank's bottom lines, and therefore the bottom lines of anybody who's invested in banking systems. And that's where we get into problems of, what about pension funds? What kind of payouts would they see? Would there be a diminishing if housing payments weren't ultimately making it to the banks? And that, I think, just really illustrates the kind of impossibility of the whole situation. Is the further you go up, the more you realize that a lot of our economy is dependent on tenants paying the rent. And a lot of vulnerable populations are ultimately dependent on getting pension fund payouts. So again, we see this inherently antagonistic situation that's been created when really we all know we're on the same side. We all know that everybody needs a place to live and deserves the income in order to make that happen, or deserves free housing, or what have you. But we have a lot of characteristics of this system that cannot exist while giving tenants while giving everybody the right to housing. It really, I think, illustrates the need for fundamental change in the way that we see the housing market, which, by the way, the real estate accounts for 13% of this country's GDP, and oil and gas is 11%. So that gives you a picture of how much of the Canadian economy really stands on a private property model of housing.
Hi, this is Ted. Since I started this debate about what City Hall could do, I was wondering if some of the new structural funds that the feds have funneled to municipalities through the province, if some of that couldn't be used to begin paying landlords and forgiving these several months of non-payment of rental fees, which, let's face it, I mean, renters are not going to be able to come up with 3 months worth of rent in order to preserve their accommodation. This is a housing crisis in Guelph, and I would think some of that structural money from the city could be used to preserve at least the minimal housing we have now. And it may have to be deferred from roads or some of the other things that are more attractive for council to do. But we do have a housing crisis, and this is money that's supposedly to be used for municipal structural funding in different ways. And there's no way the renters are going to come up with 3 months worth of rent at the end of all this, or 4 months worth of rent, or how many rents are going to go by without payment. And that will hurt landlords if all these things are defaulted on. And it's really only governments that have the kind of money that are going to preserve things for renters and landlords, so that the animosity is lessened.
Yeah,
and people can get their lives back on track.
Mm-hmm. So, Ted, I think I'm going to bring Kinnery on to speak a little bit about the work that she's been doing with landlords on this, because I think that might help answer some of these questions that we have. So, Kinnery, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Sure. We have had landlord, I also, in case this wasn't clear, am part of Gruha, but we have had landlords come to us and say, well, hey, this is hurting me. I'm a small landlord. And what we have suggested is, you know, we have banded together as tenants. Why don't you band together as small landlords and push for residential rent relief as well as the commercial rent relief for, you know, landlords, that it's very much would be a stopgap measure for the current situation. As I was saying in the chat, we need a complete overhaul of the housing, everything, our entire system. But as a temporary thing, we suggested, you know, instead of saying, hey, tenants, you're hurting us, why not then turn that up, turn it around and say, hey, government, you're hurting us, and you know, encouraging them to push for change themselves. If that kind of answers that.
Yeah, can I speak on that too?
Yeah.
Because just a personal anecdote, I don't have a small mom and pop landlord. I have a CIBC employee who manages a real estate fund as a landlord. So he's really not sympathetic with our cause here. But that being said, we do have a property manager who's based locally and is taking care of the place. And we asked many, many times for the property management, just a young family, really, to do some lobbying on tenants' behalf. Multiple emails, 7, 8, 9, we asked them to do this, and not once did they even acknowledge the request, let alone fulfill it.
Yeah, my landlord ignored me too when I was trying to ask him to help. He wouldn't answer until I sent my money.
Yeah, that's kind of the relationship that we generally see on the ground between tenants and landlords. So it may look like it on the surface that we don't try to work with landlords, but we do to an extent that we think is reasonable, which is usually unacknowledged.
Problem with what Ron says about cities providing support for cooperative housing. And I think I'm the only person in this conversation who was involved in building a housing co-op, is that cities do not have the funding available to them based on property taxes. It is absolutely fundamental that the federal government and provinces get back into that business. Our tax base is too small. Until such time as we start engaging the federal government in actually using income tax, excise tax, every tax opportunity that they have for housing, we are going to be spinning our wheels on this. It's simply a fact that municipalities can't afford it without any funding coming from the province or federal governments. It would cost us right now to put something in the ground, a minimum of $35 million for about 100-unit supportive housing project. And that doesn't even begin to address the problem. There are a multitude of issues that we need to address on this one. And I'd like to see us address them. I think that we could actually start by engaging on the particular strategy that Toronto's engaged with right now and pushing back on provincial manifestos that provide large landlords with more authority to evict people.
Thanks, Phil. Susan had a question. I think it's relevant to this. So the city has a property tax relief program for low-income people. Does anyone actually access it, or are the thresholds too high? We don't want anyone on a fixed income to be forced out of their house, but we need to be able to raise taxes to pay for the programs we need.
Yeah, I can speak to that, Hina. Susan is absolutely correct. That tax relief program was mostly geared around seniors and people with fixed incomes. And I've always been curious at how chronically underpromoted it is. It seems deliberate. Like, if you don't know about it, you're not going to ask for it. So it is there, and as Phil mentioned, one of the things we can do is look for supplementing that, but at least make people aware that it's there. That being said, I don't want to hijack this conversation into being about property taxes or rent, but they are quite related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess just a quick addendum to that is that no matter what the income of a tenant is, they'll still be expected to pay the rent, which covers the property taxes of whoever's paying the property taxes on that unit. So it's kind of, you know, it's a good program, I would say, but not something that reaches tenants where they're at.
I've talked to people about this and suggested this program to them, and they have said point blank they don't want to use it because it cuts into their kids' inheritance. That is just mind-blowing to me. They will use reverse mortgages, which are an even bigger problem, but they will not defer taxes because they think it hurts those that are going to inherit their wealth that they have in their property. So it's there, it's just not being used.
So the next question I had is not from Heather, from Diane. So Diane asked, public health has a lot of power. Are they an ally in some form? Also doctors, nurses, housing is a number one indicator of health. Can you guys speak to that?
I don't really see public health as an ally, but also the way that they've been dealing with the pandemic has been fumbling at best. Because public health will go as far as to say everyone needs to distance and everyone needs to stay home, but they don't go as far as to talk about, you know, housing needing to be a human right and the crisis of multi-generational homes and the sickness and stuff. Like, staying home isn't always accessible for poor people.
I think I would agree with that. I don't think that, I mean, the definition of an ally is really, you know, in question here. I could see public health going as far as recommending that empty housing units be used in order to house people who have been evicted, similar to the kind of takeover of the Holiday Inn that we saw for the unsheltered population. You know, maybe that's a space that could be made available for people who have been evicted as well. But even that space already has a 2-week waiting list, which would grow if evictions were to occur at the pace that the province wants them to occur at. So, I wouldn't see public health coming out to say that there shouldn't be evictions. I don't suspect that they would want to get that wrapped up with provincial law and provincial jurisdiction, but it's possible. So maybe that's somebody who we reach out to.
Just a comment on public health, because it's a bit of a double-edged sword there. Public health has to be very careful what it does. Where it is an ally is on substandard living conditions. The challenge with that, unfortunately, is many tenants are very reluctant to rock the boat. So I'll give you an example. My son is living in a substandard situation right now, and he's moving out actually tomorrow. That particular situation that he's in, he does not want to rock the boat because he recognizes that his landed person really holds all the cards. That's when you can engage public health, but it has to be something clearly related to a public health issue. And that includes any sort of a scourge, whether it's something like cockroaches or other vermin like rats or so on and so forth. But public health has a very specific mandate.
Yeah, I would say there's potential for collaboration in a way. I mean, it's really easy to argue during a pandemic that the more people who are evicted, the higher the risk of transmission. That's a really simple argument to lay out. But we haven't heard them making any noise on the lifting of the eviction moratorium yet, which I would expect coming from that really simple argument. But maybe if they're pushed on the matter, they could come after it a bit.
Yeah, for sure. It's actually really interesting hearing about this, because it didn't really occur to me, but it kind of makes sense that they might be an ally. But then it's interesting hearing, you know, the intricacies involved with how they've maybe not gotten involved to the degree that they should.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to our guests and all who joined in for a very informative discussion. If you'd like more information about Gruha, their website is GuelphRentersUnion.com. Special thanks to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Alt, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gavert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions, or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. And thank you for listening.